Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fifth generation cellular wireless, or 5G, launched last week in Chicago and Minneapolis. Sasha Segan is lead mobile analyst for PC Mag. He's been covering the rollout and visited Chicago to test the service. He joins us by phone. Welcome, Sasha Segan.
Thanks for having me.
So is the world a different and better place in Chicago now that they have 5G?
Not really. This was a very early, very preliminary launch, mostly so that Verizon could get bragging rights over some South Korean carriers over who would be the world's first to have a 5G phone. It's nothing that's really usable yet. It's the beginning of a long road to better service.
What does 5G, can you compare and contrast 5G to 4G, for example, what we can do now and what 5G brings to us once it's fully operational?
Yeah, the major advantages of 5G will be much lower latency, much higher peak and average speeds, and a larger number of devices addressable on the network. And so what that means is networks will be much more responsive, which can have effects for robotics, self-driving cars, virtual and augmented reality. They'll be generally faster and have more capacity, which could have a real effect for home internet offerings. And they'll allow for a lot of small sensors to be connected to things, which could be interesting in things like law enforcement and agriculture.
What do you mean by lower latency?
Lower latency means that a network is more responsive. Right now, for instance, if you are trying to communicate with someone on the other end of an internet connection with 4G, there's about 40 milliseconds of delay between your action and their receipt of the action. 5G lowers that below 10 milliseconds, which means things like self-driving cars reacting to each other will be able to stop in time rather than hitting each other.
So this is really important in communities where they're envisioning a lot of smart transportation.
Yeah, smart transportation, smart city type things are definitely big with 5G. I've seen a demo, for instance, of 5G-enabled security and traffic cameras that are very high resolution, and they use 5G's high data rates to be able to identify specific vehicles for things like smart tolling and smart management of HOV lanes, that sort of thing.
When you talk about in the future, when this gets fully operational, how much of a future? I'm always confused when I'm talking about tech, because for tech people, the future is 6 months away. That's a long time. For the rest of us, it's around the corner. So what are we talking about here?
I think we're going to have broad 5G access in 2021, probably. It's going to take about, we've just started to build this network, it's going to take about 2 years for this network to become broadly available. But, of course, tech fans like my readers are going to be excited to hear every little advance as it comes.
And when you're talking about building this network, what do we mean by building a 5G network? What's happening?
So what's happening is that carriers are putting new panels onto their various cell sites. In some cases, they're putting up a lot of new cell sites, especially in central city areas. And they're upgrading all of the software across their network and speeding up the landline internet connections that go into the cell sites to prepare for much more traffic.
When you were in Chicago, what differences did you know, or if any?
Honestly, there's not 5G is not better than 4G yet. I got to test a couple of very early sites that were on average 50% faster than 4G, but with a very short range. It only covered a couple of neighborhoods. It was a bit faster. It's just the beginning of the experience.
Why did Verizon launch in Chicago and Minneapolis? What were the pros and cons of that?
I'm not particularly sure why those two cities. I think Chicago had to do with the fact that they're using a Motorola phone as their initial 5G phone, and Motorola's headquarters are in Chicago, so it's easy for Motorola to test out their equipment in Chicago And that was logistically easy for them to pull off.
And Minneapolis, just it's a little scaled down?
Yeah, Minneapolis, I'm not quite sure why Minneapolis. They're just covering the downtown area of Minneapolis. I don't know what Verizon's concerns there were, but Verizon does say that they'll be covering at least the downtown areas of 30 different cities by the end of the year.
And you said they went with a Motorola phone. That means that if you have an iPhone, for instance, it won't work at all?
No, I don't believe iPhones are going to have access to 5G until late 2020 or maybe even late 2021. The next phone coming is going to be a Samsung 5G phone in May. Now, there is one thing you need to watch out for, which is that AT&T changed the 4G indicator on a lot of iPhones to say something like 5GE. That's not actually 5G. It's really just the same 4G network. AT&T just changed the indicator to make their network look different.
I get how the 40 milliseconds versus wait time versus 10 milliseconds makes a difference when we're talking about a smart city and managing traffic and that kind of a thing. Does it make much difference to the average user?
Well, it'll make difference when it comes to new applications. For instance, I was talking to companies that have streaming video games. And so this is video games that are, it's like playing really high-end PC video games, which are popular among tens of millions of people, on your phone, which doesn't necessarily have the processing capacity. It's playing it remotely to a computer in the cloud. You can't do that right now really over an LTE network. It's too laggy. But you'll be able to do that over 5G. So that's one application.
And as the number of users of smart technology increase, is 5G going to even be able to keep up with that? In other words, is there going to be a 6G out there somewhere?
There's a new G about every 10 years, and the real academics have started working on a wish list for 6G. They had their first 6G conference back in March, but that's targeting 2030. 5G is designed to handle whatever the needs are going to be of the 2020s, just like 4G was for the 2010s.
Who gets to decide what 4G or 5G or 6G will handle? Is it the providers or what?
There's a big industry group called the 3GPP, made up of all of the providers and phone makers and infrastructure companies and a whole bunch of academics from all around the world. The 3GPP gets together in various working groups, and they decide the standards over a period of years. And then the providers and infrastructure companies create their products to these standards.
And the standards, what international body. So in and of itself, it's an international body?
Yeah, the 3GPP is a global body. It works with the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. The two of them work pretty tightly together.
Well, I guess the world gets along on some level. Why this big international competition for 5G? I don't remember. And granted, I just may not remember. But was there that big of a deal when 4G came out?
Smartphones are a bigger thing now.
Yeah.
In 2010, when carriers were launching 4G, everybody didn't have a smartphone. Now everybody has a smartphone. Everybody's aware of this. And so getting the bragging rights out there to be able to splash first on 5G on a big billboard over the highway is kind of a big deal for some of these marketing organizations.
Yeah, and I suppose it's something, you know, it makes me wonder about, say, Apple or something not blowing out another big phone again right away. Why do it until you can do 5G?
Apple's going to release a phone every year, and
yeah.
Apple is going to have their spin, which is we'll do 5G when it's ready.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to do 5G before it's time. Don't worry, Apple will have a way to spin this,
mm-hmm.
and Samsung will spin it a different way, and welcome to capitalism.
Yeah, I'm wondering what can benefit from 5G before 2021?
If you have 5G coverage in the relatively limited downtowny areas where you'll have 5G coverage, for instance, it's going to offer a new option for home internet coverage to people who may only have one option from their cable provider right now. That's a plus. This gaming application that I
mm-hmm.
described,
yeah.
that's going to kick in later this year. There's going to be other new applications that are going to pop up. I've already heard it being used in different kinds of businesses, for instance, construction and architecture firms transferring very large files from job sites. It's easier over 5G. It's right now 50% faster than it was over 4G.
And are the phones going to have to change that much?
The phones will ultimately look the same initially. Eventually, there's going to be new devices entirely. I think a lot of the industry wants to do augmented reality glasses, like those horrible Google Glass, which failed, but they were just before their time.
Mm-hmm.
But we will see 5G smartphones that look like 4G smartphones, and then we'll start to see things like wearables and glasses and cellular-enabled clothing, probably in the 2023 to 2025 realm, entirely new ideas.
When are they going to start implanting the chips in us?
I don't think that is coming anytime soon. I think there are too many health and safety issues there, as well as upgradability issues. I think that's something for scary dystopian sci-fi.
My favorite kind. Sasha Segan, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Sasha Segan, lead mobile analyst for PC Magazine. We've been talking about the rollout of 5G. Don't get too excited. You're not going to see many changes until about 2021. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. What if you could read about the reliability of an online news or information site like you read the nutrition labels on a box of crackers? That's the idea behind a new startup established to rate more than 2,000 news and information sites. Eric Efron is the editorial director at NewsGuard, founded by two veteran news executives to help the rest of us suss fact from fiction. He joins us by phone. Welcome, Eric Efron.
Great to be here. Thank you.
The new startup is called NewsGuard. Who are the founders? Where did they come from?
Yeah, our two co-founders, as you said, are both sort of veterans of the journalism world. Stephen Brill is a former head of Court TV. He's launched a couple of other of entrepreneurial journalism sites and has a background in helping other companies figure out how to make how to sort of monetize their news offerings. And Gordon Krovitz is a former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and is on the board of many media companies. So both of them have had long and successful careers in the media business.
What's the difference between NewsGuard and just fact-checking organizations?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of very good fact-checking organizations out there that really focus on at the article level or at the claim level, which is to say they'll tell you if something that an article is true or if a claim that a politician made is true. What makes us different is we operate on the site level. We look at websites and assess them based on some of their basic journalism practices. So, for example, very basic things. Do they run corrections? Do they tell you who owns them? To some more serious things, like do they publish false news? And we write reviews of the websites based on these criteria with the intention of giving consumers more information about the news they consume. So when they encounter an article either that somebody shares on Facebook or that they get through a Google search, you can quickly ascertain by clicking on our icon, what is this website standards? Should I trust this site? Should I take what I'm getting with a grain of salt? We're particularly interested in whether or not a website has an agenda. And if they do have an agenda, that's fine, mm-hmm. but we would want them to disclose their agenda. So basically, the reason we call them nutrition labels is we do want people to be sort of smarter consumers of information. at a time when misinformation and disinformation and propaganda is arguably one of the biggest challenges facing not just the United States, but, you know, democracies and countries around the world.
How did your team decide on the kinds of ratings it would give? How did you go through that process?
Well, we come out of a journalism background. Mm-hmm. So really what we're saying is, and this is kind of old-fashioned, but we want to be able to judge websites based on their credibility and transparency. And, you know, there's a lot of new media, some of which is fantastic and high level and some of which is really up to no good. And there are some old guard media which does very good work but also might have some flaws. What we try to do is rate and judge and assess those websites according to the same criteria. So we're not making ideological judgments. We're not making political judgments. We're making judgments based on some standards and practices that we assess by both by looking at the site very closely, by talking to the site, interviewing folks responsible, and doing other reporting, again, to just try to get a handle on things. And some of it might seem so basic, but who owns this website? You know, many websites don't tell you that. So we'll do some digging around and tell readers, you know what, this is owned by the same company or the same person that has these other websites that may be problematic or has these undisclosed agendas because, for example, they're associated with an industry group, but they don't tell you that. So you're getting kind of pro-industry propaganda when you think you're reading news. So we really just try to not make, you know, decisions for people about what they should read, but that if you're going to read this, you should know this information about the website.
And this isn't just about politics and public policy. This could be like a site you're looking at to learn more about psoriasis. It could be run by a company that makes treatments for psoriasis.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad that you mentioned health because really, even though most of us think about politics when we think about fake news or propaganda, there's probably more misinformation and disinformation out there about health than there is about politics. So we make a point of focusing also on and reviewing on the health sites. And again, we do that by looking at their content, by saying, you know, are there any undisclosed agendas? Is this a website that you can believe? Do they tell you who they are? Do they tell you if they're a medical site? And they're doing reviews of a new drug, do they tell you if the writer has any kind of relationship with the pharmaceutical company, that sort of thing. And we have found some very, very disturbing sort of fake news or false news sites in the health space, and I think that's one of the real values we bring.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Eric Efron. He's editorial director at NewsGuard. It was founded by two veteran news executives to help the rest of us kind of suss fact from fiction and give sort of nutrition labels to different sites that proliferate every day. If you have a question or comment for Eric Efron, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Eric, how do you envision the average everyday, web surfer using your service?
Yeah, so that's a great question. For people who have the Microsoft Edge mobile browser, and if your listeners don't, I urge them to do that. Our content is actually integrated into that platform. So when you go to, say, the New York Times or even WOSU's website via the mobile Edge browser, you'll actually see in the address bar our nutrition label symbol that you can click on and then read the entire write-up. We also have a plugin that's free and available on our website, newsguardtech.com. Anybody can download that, and then once you do that, when you do search on most browsers, when the results come up, you'll again see our icon next to your search results. So if you're doing research into, say, fracking, and one of the results comes up and you say, oh, this seems interesting, you'll click on it and then you'll find out, well, actually, this is a website that's from the fracking industry, even though they don't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll know to be a little skeptical about reading that information.
More than 500 news websites have made changes to their standards and disclosures after NewsGuard gave them feedback. What kind of feedback are you giving? How does that work?
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing that up, because that's really one of the most gratifying, I think, things we've experienced here at NewsGuard. Is that the websites that we've been reviewing, many of them really take seriously their responsibility. And so when we get in touch with them and we say, you know what, we've noticed that you never run corrections. Is it possible that you haven't made a mistake in 10 years? they'll say, you know what, you're right. We really need a better corrections policy. Some things are very simple, like they have an About Us page, but they don't say on the About Us page who their owner is. So in the course of doing our reporting, one of our basic journalism practices here is, we're not going to say anything negative about anybody or any site without giving them a chance to comment. So in the process of doing that, we've had, as you've said, over 500 websites have actually, what I would say, up their game or change their standards as a result of either our inquiries or once we've published and they, they read what we wrote about them and they, they kind of decide, maybe we should kind of come around on this criteria.
A lot of times, a lot of these sites are run by people who aren't necessarily hardcore journalists.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. We have, many sites, especially ones that have started in the last, several years, the more ideological or political ones, they're starting with an agenda which is not what I think you and I would consider a journalistic agenda, but really a political agenda. Mm-hmm. And so they're not really thinking of themselves as journalists, which is fine. They don't have to. But our point is that consumers should know whether or not this website has journalistic standards. And so, we'll have sites that we'll get in touch with, and by engaging with us, that's really the first time some of these sites have actually even thought of some of these things, because, they didn't come at it from a journalistic standpoint. But even those kinds of sites see the value in being more transparent and, being more upfront with their readers and their customers. So I think we've had a positive impact both on the mainstream journalism sites and even on some of the ones that aren't.
How do you decide which sites to review?
Well, so our goal is to review and rate the sites that are responsible for most of the engagement on social media in the United States. So we've identified about 2,000 or so sites that are responsible for about 96% of engagement, which means people sharing news on social media on various platforms. So that's a little different than saying these are the sites with the most traffic on their websites. But the point is, most of us now get our news not by going to a website, but by disaggregated form, which is to say it floats around and you might see it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You'll see it in a search result. So our thinking is, because that's really how most people encounter information, where we should be is where those little snippets of information are floating around. So the top lines that you see on Facebook when a friend of yours posts an article, that sort of thing. So we've now accounted for 96% of all of social media shares in the U.S., and we're now starting to take our game to Europe and are looking at websites in France, Italy, Germany, and the U.K. You won't be surprised to know that the United States does not have a monopoly on false news and misinformation and propaganda. In fact, the problems in some markets in Europe, and especially as you get into Eastern Europe and mm-hmm. get closer to Russia, the problem there is even more acute. And so we have had a wonderful reception in Europe as we start to gear up over there.
How are you monetizing this?
That is maybe your best question yet, I have to say. So we do not charge the end user, which is to say the consumer. We do not charge the websites that we're reviewing. Instead, our revenue model is we are licensing our content to the tech platforms. So arguably, if I could be blunt, mm-hmm. the companies that inadvertently kind of got us into this mess to mm-hmm. some extent. So those are the search engines, mm-hmm. the big platforms that are, we all know and love. So our big first customer is Microsoft, which is why I earlier said download the their mobile browser. Mm-hmm. But we're engaged in conversations, across the board with all of the tech platforms. We're a very good solution for the Facebooks of the world and Google as they get sort of beat up by legislators and their customers over this problem. It's not one that they really can solve themselves. They don't think of themselves as publishers, and they don't take responsibility for the most part for what they publish. And so we are really a good solution for them because, then what they can tell their customers is that, when you get information shared over our website, over our platform, that you'll have this, additional information that you can use to make a decision about whether this is a link you want to click on or not.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you have about 50 journalists working with you now?
Yeah, so we have between our freelancers and staff, it's probably around 40 or something like that now. As we're getting into Europe, we're expanding over there. And everybody that works here, I think without exception, has a journalism background because really what we're doing is a form of journalism itself. Mm-hmm. We try to be accurate, obviously. We try to be fair. And we try to be transparent and, talk about glass houses. We are, mm-hmm. We have to be we have to make sure that we get the top score that, if somebody did a NewsGuard rating of us. So, on our website, we have, extensive biographies of all the people that work here. Even though we don't have a website where we publish all of our corrections, we do have a place on our site for any publisher who wants to complain about one of their ratings. We make a point of including a lot of comment from sites on the write-ups themselves. So we are approaching this journalistically. And, again, as I said, we have a no surprises rule. We will call up and make sure that we give opportunity for fair comment. Most of the efforts by Facebook and Google to do something about this problem have been driven by algorithms and and software. And there's definitely some value there, but we think actually having a human being who can pick up the phone and try to get a comment and really try to understand the nuances is something that really should be part of the media landscape as well.
Has any site ever said, "We don't care what you think"?
But not so politely. But, we have enemies. We gave RT, formerly Russia Today, a negative write-up, and they immediately went on a kind of a campaign against us, saying that we were the propaganda site. Mm-hmm. We've had some, public, back and forth with some other sites. So, nobody's shy out there. Everybody that we rate, they by definition have a way to reach their own public. And so, some sites, that haven't liked our rating have written extensively about us on their own sites. So, that comes with the territory. But like I said, we need to be transparent and, not hide from what we're writing about. And the other thing is, when we make a mistake or we feel like, we think we were too hard on that site or too soft, we'll go back and we'll adjust it and we'll explain why we did it.
How long have you guys been around? I only heard about you last week and I asked my producers to check this out. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, well, so we've been around a year. For the first several months, we were, creating content, not necessarily publishing it, but for the last several months, we've been out in force, especially once we got our plugin out. And so the company is just a year old, and we have now rated over 2,200 or 2,300 U.S. sites, and we're rating. We do more every day. We make a point of having the top 1,000, and so depending on the number of sites come in and out of that group. We can't just do a review and let it sit there. We have to keep them updated. Mm-hmm. Things change, ownership changes, standards change. So, we're constantly going back and making sure that the review that we wrote 4 months ago or 5 months ago is still holding up.
I was wondering if there was a shock factor for all of this, for all of you in this. When you started to do this, were you pleasantly surprised, horrified, or was it about what you expected?
Well, I think that I was pleasantly surprised at the impact that we had so quickly with with websites that were very open and willing to engage with us. So in that sense, that was uplifting. You know, on the other hand, I now spend a lot of time looking at some pretty ugly and horrible sites that, you know, are kind of depressing. And so, you know, this has kind of also forced us to go a little bit into the dark corners of the internet where we probably, you know, wouldn't go otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, and I'm, you know, I'm sure we've, you know, you too have kind of poked around there. It's, you know, it can be sort of shocking.
Mm-hmm.
We do not only reviews of websites, but also platforms, you know, which are, you know, the sites that are kind of open and, you know, anybody can post, but they all have different standards and practices.
Like Reddit, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, Reddit. And YouTube, and we're just working on one now for 4chan, which is a kind of, you know, conspiracy theory site with a lot of racism and porn and, you know, but is hugely popular. So, you know, it's not pretty. I guess the other thing that sort of struck me is there is a lot of really, really good stuff out there. You know, we're not just reviewing sort of big national, you know, titles, but we're looking at local websites. We're looking at the websites for, you know, local TV channels. And, you know, despite a lot of cutbacks and economic pressures, you know, on journalism in the last decade or so, you know, we still see some really good work. And one of the things that we try to do on our labels is recognize that. So, for example, if, you know, a local newspaper has, you know, gotten recognized for awards for, you know, particularly ambitious or impactful stories, you know, we'll mention that on the web, on the write-up. Again, it's just a small way to sort of acknowledge the good work that's out there and, you know, maybe encourage more of it.
Eric Efron, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for your interest, and I'm happy to be able to speak to you and your audience, and I wish you the best.
I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Eric Efron, editorial director at NewsGuard. It was founded by a couple of veteran news executives to help the rest of us figure out fact from fiction when it comes to all of those sites as they proliferate on the internet. We will continue with Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple released its second generation of wireless headphones called AirPods. They pair easily with other devices. They're comfortable, but they aren't cheap. Joining us to talk about that and more tech news is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So this is for someone who has Apple products. How does AirPod work with your phone, your iPad, your computer?
Yeah, so I mean, out of the box, these things are designed to connect to all of your Apple products kind of seamlessly. Like you open the little lid on the AirPods and your Apple product in front of you will fire up a little thing that says, hey, we actually see that there are AirPods nearby. Do you want to connect to them? Which is super convenient and a lot easier than you get with a lot of other Bluetooth accessories. And you can actually, jump between devices with relative ease. So if you are out running and using your phone, and then you come back to your laptop, as long as your laptop is made by Apple, then you can actually pretty easily switch those headphones over so that you're never really going through that kind of awkward repairing phase that you see with a lot of Bluetooth headphones. But that really ends up being one of the only real features that sets these headphones apart from a lot of the others. Between this and the ability to activate Siri, with a voice prompt, that you already have on your phone and on your watch and in other places that Apple provides.
What has changed between the generations?
The biggest change between the generations is a battery boost. The case itself has an available option for battery for wireless charging if you pay extra for it. There's some better battery, and then the ability to recognize that Siri command at all times. Is something that works better in this version.
Can you only use this with Apple products?
You can use this with other products, but you lose some functionality. So obviously, you're going to lose the ability to do the Hey Siri thing. There's a tap function on the side of the headphones that allow you to kind of switch tracks while playing music or play and pause, if you walk up to someone and they're talking to you. And those features go away when you're paired to other things. They don't work quite as well or at all in some cases. But they still act as Bluetooth headphones when connected to anything.
If you had $160 to spend on headphones, would you buy them?
No, not at all.
Okay.
So the thing is that, for $160, you're not getting headphones that sound particularly good. And that kind of seems like the thing that should be the important feature for headphones when you get them. And there are other, wireless headphones that operate very similarly to these that just have a lot more to offer when it comes to audio quality and features. Samsung makes a set of headphones now called Galaxy Buds that offer a real-time audio pass-through, which means that someone can actually walk up to you and be talking to you, and you can press pause on the headphones or the music or whatever it is that you're listening to and never actually need to remove the headphones without perfectly hearing the people that are around you, because there's actually microphones built into the headphones to amplify the noises that are around you in those situations. So you get... There are just a lot of other headphones out there that offer a better overall audio experience. There's often some kind of other trade-off. Sometimes the battery life isn't as great, and very few other headphones have this kind of rapid pairing system that works. But even things that are built within Apple's own ecosystem, the Beats headphones that wrap around for athletic users will offer better battery life and just kind of a better audio quality system than what you get with AirPods.
I feel like this is the age of the headphone. It seems like we talk about it almost every week, some kind of new headphone out.
There's a lot of big push right now with headphones because Apple and Motorola and several other companies got rid of the headphone jack in phones. And so having to switch to wireless headphones means that if you're going to spend that money anyway, you might as well be spending that money on something that you know you're going to be using for a while. Because, headphones used to just be, especially with phones, the thing that came in the box was the thing that you used. Mm-hmm. And that's not an option anymore. So as people are moving to other things, choosing something that works and is going to last, it really just depends on how you're using your headphones and where you're using your headphones.
If you do have Apple devices, are there other headphones that will work just as well with them as the AirPods? And give you that better quality of sound and that kind of a thing? Or is the AirPod the best deal for an Apple person?
No, I think that Beats Audio, so what you get here, there's another set that Beats Audio makes that is actually owned by Apple that is sold in Apple stores, and they have a better sound quality. They're wraparound headphones, which means they're not completely wireless like these are. The AirPods, you take these little buds out and you stick them in one at a time. And they're completely wireless, whereas these have a cable that connects the two buds, but it's still wireless between the headphones themselves and the phone. And I think that those sound a lot better and are offered at a pretty comparable price and are actually often on sale a lot more often than AirPods are. And so if you're an Apple person and really like that kind of instant connectability, between your devices, that's probably the one that I would recommend to you over AirPods. But if you're not using an Apple product, there are just several other options that will get you a much better experience.
I still think the AirPod look is kind of weird.
It is kind of weird. And
I'm getting used to it.
It's one of those things that I wish I saw in other colors.
Yes.
Given that we see iPhones released in like six different colors now, it's weird to have this kind of glossy white thing hanging out of your ear.
Yes.
So having them in different colors would be something that I would vote for kind of immediately. But, mm-hmm. The iPod... headphones were part of Apple's marketing scheme for almost a decade. The black and white, pictures of people with the white earbuds coming mm-hmm. out. It was an iconic thing that everyone saw and knew that person was probably using an Apple product. So I get why Apple is sticking to this color, but man, I wish they would stop.
Get over it. Let's see. There is a new totally customizable controller on the market for PlayStation 4. What do you have to customize on these things? Tell me.
So this is a weird thing to get excited about unless you really play a ton of games all the time. But yes, SCUF makes a controller called the Vantage. And this controller is designed to let you adjust where the buttons on the controller are, how the buttons react when you push, how much resistance they give you, how many buttons are on the controller. And these are things that probably don't matter to someone who occasionally picks up a controller and starts playing, but it matters a lot more to someone who is, you know, playing perhaps competitively, or if they're just playing online a lot and they want just that little bit of an advantage, then having something that fits your hand a little better ends up making a lot more sense. And so that's what this is designed for.
How do they do it? How does it work?
A lot of it is just having the buttons themselves tucked away in a slightly larger controller with some you know, kind of controls underneath of the plate of it. So, like, you have the kind of cover to the controller mm-hmm. that you can remove. And when you remove that cover, you have some very simple calibration tools that you can use. And also just a whole lot of options in the box for how comfortable the buttons and joysticks and things are. If you prefer kind of the glossy, hard thumbsticks that don't have a lot of grip, then those are in the box. But if you want something that's got the kind of a rubbery texture so that it kind of sticks to your finger almost, then those options are there too. And you can just kind of pull one out and put the other in.
And it's pretty easy to change them out?
It's very easy to change out, but it is a little disconcerting to see, you know, you're kind of ripping a controller apart. and that can be a little unusual.
What about battery life? Does it affect that?
Battery life, you get a little bit of extra, you know, battery here because it is a larger controller, and you do have a little more space to put some things in. Mm-hmm. So the battery life compared to, say, a normal PlayStation controller is going to end up being a little more, but not so much that I think you're going to really notice on a regular basis. You're still going to want to charge this at roughly the same time. You just are probably not going to need to worry about it if you pick it up and hadn't charged it in a couple of days.
What's the issue with the faceplate?
The faceplate is just a customization thing. If you want, you know, the different colors, or if you want, you know, a custom design for the front of your controller, if you don't just want that kind of flat black or gray that comes with a normal PlayStation mm-hmm. controller, then you can have that here.
Like, what are the choices? I mean, what is it, glitter?
you can get, you know, kind of a silver or bright green, or, you know, there are a couple different options that are actually included in the packaging.
Oh.
But you can buy them separately. You know, if you have, you know, some custom design that you want to send to SCUF to get printed on it, then that's an option that you can have. It really is just a visual flourish.
A visual flourish. I love that. Bitmoji, you could now use it on your Fitbit. What is Bitmoji?
I'm so glad you asked. So there's this thing that came out a little while ago. It's been out for a couple of years now, where you can create custom emoji and kind of pictures that are very animated, that instead of having kind of the flat yellow smiley face, actually uses an animated version of your face. Bitmoji will let you kind of take a picture of your face and send it to them, and they'll turn it into a series of you know, personalized emoji. They're very silly. They're kind of fun looking. That you have just some people who use them for every single thing, no matter what, and you have other people who cannot stand them and get very angry when they are used. And I have both in my office place, which makes it a lot of fun. And so to kind of continue being able to personalize things with your face, Fitbit has made it so that any of their devices that are watch size, so like the Fitbit Versa or the Fitbit Ionic, now have the ability to use your Bitmoji design in watch faces. So one of the, you know, if it's your birthday, then there's, you know, it'll have, or if you've beaten your step goal or something like that, then the watch face will change to your character kind of, you know, throwing confetti around because you've accomplished something, or, you know, just a bunch of very, very silly things.
I find that I can kind of illustrate my life with two emojis, the one where they're laughing while they cry, and the other one with the big round eyes, kind of the sorry emoji. This is kind of all.
Yeah, I mean, that probably works for most people. But once you get hooked on this whole Bitmoji thing, it's really kind of difficult to put down.
Well, especially with your exercise. I mean, do you use it a lot?
I don't use it at all.
Okay.
I think Bitmoji are terrible. But yeah, the people that I work with and the people that in my life who use it really love just the personalization. They like being able to create these designs that are very personal. And yes, being able to use it on a Fitbit gives you that kind of extra bit of personalization where you've reached a step goal or you are using it to log food, to be able to have that kind of animated, motivation or sense of accomplishment that goes with it. That's more than just kind of the generic, thumbs up. Definitely has value for people who are relying on these things to keep themselves motivated.
But I can't use it on my Apple Watch. This is a Fitbit thing, right?
This is just for Fitbit. Your Apple Watch does not want you to have personal watch faces ever. You get to choose the 30 or so that they give you, and that's it.
How big of a deal do you think this personalization and customization is going to be? I mean, we just talked about the controller for PlayStation 2 being customizable, not just in a comfort way, but also in a visual way. Now we have Bitmoji. I mean, how is this another thing?
Personalization when it comes to a lot of electronics is a really big deal. It's one of the biggest reasons that smartphone cases are such a big market that they are, because you're able to buy something that separates the design of the phone from, from everyone else. So you're able to look down and see that this is definitely mine. And so being able to do that in anything that you have around you, I think is a pretty important thing when it's offered in a way that gives you a lot of control.
Palm phone, we've talked about it before, but there's been an update. First of all, refresh our memory on what the Palm phone is and then what's new.
Sure. So, late last year, Verizon announced that you could buy for $300 a phone that you could use when you didn't want to use the phone that you already spent money on. So if you were like going out on the weekend, but you didn't want to bring your big phone with you, you just wanted something quick for like phone calls and Twitter or something, you could bring this smaller, less useful phone with you and have it just be like your weekend phone and leave your big phone at home. And nobody really understood why you would do that. So Verizon is not letting you do that anymore. Instead, you can just buy this phone as a phone that you can just use on Verizon's network. And it's no longer $300, it's now $200. So instead of forcing you to only buy it if you are using it as an accessory for your existing phone, you can actually just buy this as a phone for someone, which for people who are looking for first phone for a kid or a phone, if you're just really one of those people who cannot stand big phones and you want a small phone, like this is actually a fairly reasonable option. For the price that you're getting it for.
So is this a fail or is this like a rebound? What do you rank this?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely changing course because nobody was buying this thing, which is, when this thing first came out, people who have smartwatches will spend, $200 on a smartwatch that gives you some extra phone things on your wrist so that you don't have to pull your phone out of your pocket 100 times a day.
Right.
So spending $350 on a phone-sized thing that basically did all of those same things was just kind of a very silly thing. As neat as it looked and as iconic a brand as Palm is, this just wasn't something that anyone was going to do. And so, yes, this is an attempt to kind of save face a little bit on what is kind of a quirky little gadget that could be useful to a lot more people now.
But now you can't use it as a companion device, right?
I think you probably could if you asked Verizon to set it up that way.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I'm still not sure why anybody would do that.
Russell
the idea of a weekend phone is just amazing.
Yeah, what have we come to? Russell Holley, thank you so much, as always, for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Russell Holley. He's a contributing editor at Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.